countertop to the door. They passed in wordless terror through the dining room. A long brown slick of spilled coffee stained the crocheted cloth, the last his mother had made, the intricate pattern Donegal, home of his and Nora's good and decent ancestors. On the table were a dirty ashtray and a pack of Camels, a thin white plastic purse hanging on the back of a chair by its cracked and brittle strap swayed as he and his cousin passed by. Something was terribly wrong.
"Just go to bed, Tom," Nora whispered at the top of the stairs as he struggled toward Father Gannon's bedroom.
"Not until I find out what happened to Mrs. Arkaday," he said, turning the young priest's doorknob. "Father Gannon," he barked into the musky heat that now, as the hall light bled into the darkness, was a sudden, muddied swirl of naked limbs, an angry curse, and then a sobbing, hunched whiteness over which a thrown sheet was settling.
"No, no, 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 no,"
the woman bleated beneath the quivering sheet.
"Get out of here. Just get the hell out,"
his bollocky curate roared, shoving him toward the hallway, where Nora stood staring, her hand over her mouth. Staggering, the Monsignor clutched the doorframe.
"No! In the name of Jesus, no! Not now or ever!" he panted. "You! Out of here this minute, you terrible woman! You vile and disgusting!"
The two men struggled as Father Gannon pried his fingers from the wood, then pushed him away and shut the door.
"Tom!"
Nora gasped as he tried to open it, and finding it locked, pounded on it with his fist, demanding to be let in.
"Stop it! Stop it!" she insisted. "You're just going to hurt yourself."
She held onto his hand.
"Let them get dressed," she said at his ear in a low, hard voice.
"This is more than a heinous sin," he cried. "This is a violation, the worst betrayal I could imagine."
He looked at her, choking on his tears. His beefsteaks, his Brecci Cordell, his mother's cloth, his legacy tainted and consumed by lust.
"My curate and my housekeeper."
"No, Tom, that's a young girl. It's Alice Vermoyle."
He was relieved, then shocked and disgusted and angry all over again.
"I want her out of here this minute," he thundered.
Father Gannon said they'd come out as soon as the hallway was empty. The Monsignor made his way downstairs, with Nora holding his arm. He went directly to the kitchen, where he removed the two sets of car keys from the brass hooks by the door. So now it all made sense. All the late nights, the odd stains on the upholstery, the greasy whorl on the door glass. As Nora Hines's Lincoln floated through the night, Alice kept her face to the window, but her eyes were closed. It had come full circle. The bastard conception that had driven Nora Hines away was now being delivered by Nora Hines to her mother without any underpants on. It had been a terrible scene. When the Monsignor refused to let Joe drive her home, Joe had smashed a wine glass on the wall, bellowing that he couldn't take any more of it, that he was through, through, through. God damn it, he was through. The Monsignor kept ordering him to his room while she sobbed in the foyer. The Monsignor staggered to the phone and said he'd call her mother to come and get her out of there. Joe grabbed his arm and warned him not to. That's when Nora Hines, ashen-faced and trembling, said she'd drive Alice home. Alice tried not to smile. Home. All the ugliness and discord, her breath stale with alcohol, her thighs sticky with lovemaking, and now they all knew. Well, good. It was about time. About time, about time. "It's a little after one," Nora Hines said. Had she asked the time, Alice wondered? Nora Hines sat so erectly behind the wheel that she towered over Alice.
"Maybe I've shrunk. Maybe I can. Maybe I can. If I stop breathing and try real hard."
But now they turned down the street, and here came her pathetic little house, light glaring through the cracked globe over the front door, which opened the minute they pulled into the driveway.
"No, no, no,"
she groaned, shaking her head as her grim-eyed mother waited around the front of the car through the shimmering headlights, with Norm at her heels, bending low a moment to see his fucked-up, dirty, crazy sister. She covered her face with her hands. "It'll be all right," Nora Hines said to Alice. "She's very upset," Nora Hines told her mother, who was trying to pull her gently from the car. But with her arms and legs gone to stone, that was going to be impossible, because now she couldn't move, didn't know how anymore.
"I'll lift her out," Norm said, leaning in to get his arms under her. But for a grunting moment, he could not dislodge her.
"Alice," her mother commanded.
"Poor thing's terribly upset," Nora Hines said, with her fingertips at her mouth as if she might cry. "Come on, Alice," Norm grunted, as he managed to get her legs out and his arms around her shoulders. "Let's just get in the house," he kept whispering as he guided her up the walk. "Just get inside and everything'll be okay."
"No, it won't," she said, as they climbed the front steps. "It'll never be okay. Never, ever again."
Norm brought her to her room, where she lay in her dress with her eyes closed. Her mother came in and sat on the edge of the bed for a long time without saying anything.
"I have come full circle into the darkness."
"This is all my fault," her mother said. "I should have known. Oh, baby, I haven't really seen you all summer. You were always such a good girl. I didn't think I had to worry much about you. But it's going to be all right. You'll see. I haven't told the boys yet, honey. At first I wanted to wait until the soap came, and then your father's been trying so hard with his new job, and I didn't want him all upset. But Omar and I are engaged, Alice. He gave me this beautiful diamond. Would you like to see it? I'll turn on the light. Well, you can see it in the morning, then. You sleep now, and in the morning everything will start to look better, I promise."
The bed shook, and Alice covered her face with her hands. She couldn't stop laughing.
"Don't cry," her mother whispered, leaning close now. "Please, Alice, listen to me. We all make mistakes. Everyone does."
She pulled her hands away.
"Alice, Alice, stop that. I said stop it right now."
She grabbed her and dug her fingers into Alice's arms.
"This will be over, do you hear me? It's not going to change anything. Tomorrow morning you'll get up, just the way I've gotten up every morning, every day of my life, and you'll start all over again, do you hear me? Because this isn't going to stop you. Nothing's going to stop you, nothing. Do you hear me? Do you? Do you? God damn it, answer me!"
The door burst open. It was Norm demanding that she leave her alone. She was too upset. Couldn't she see that?
"Upset? She's laughing. Look at her. Look at her laying there laughing."
"You know she's not laughing," his voice broke. "Jesus Christ, Mom, she's falling apart."
"No," Marie cried. "No, that's too easy. You don't just fall apart and leave everyone else to pick up the pieces."
She paced back and forth between Norm and Alice, who had pulled the pillow over her head.
"What you do is, you keep on going," she panted,
chopping the side of her hand into her palm.
"You keep on going and going and going and going and going, goddammit, until you just can't do it anymore, until you're dead, goddammit, that's when you stop."
She leaned over the bed.
"When you're dead, and not until then."
The Monsignor hobbled from his bedroom to the bathroom, heaving sighs of pain and disgust that caused Mrs. Arkaday's rag to scrub faster and faster. The rectory smelled of pine oil. For days, Mrs. Arkaday had been scrubbing floors, woodwork, and walls with an exculpatory zeal. The Monsignor was barely speaking to her. If she had been here that night, the incident never would have happened. Father Gannon crept into the office. He needed to talk to Alice. Every time he called, one of her brothers answered and said she didn't want to talk to anyone. This time when he dialed, her mother answered. He closed his eyes, asking for her in a whisper.
"No,"
Mrs. Vermoyle said.
"You can't."
"I have to speak to her, Mrs. Vermoyle. You don't understand," he said.
"Oh, I understand all right,"
she said. "No, no, you don't. You see, I love Alice."
"For God's sake, you're a priest,"
she growled. "But that doesn't matter.
It matters to me,"
What matters is Alice's happiness, he said.
Then leave her alone.
I can't.
Well, if you can't, then I'm calling the Monsignor. And if that doesn't work, I'll call the police.
Mrs. Vermoyle, Mrs. Vermoyle, please, he begged. But she'd hung up.
The office door swung open and the Monsignor limped in, holding his side, his face pinched with pain and shock.
You're forcing my hand, Father Gannon. I swear to you, if you have anything more to do with that girl, then I'm going to call the bishop. Call the bishop. Call the police. Call my mother. Call everyone. Who gives a shit?
He couldn't help laughing. They were trying to back him into a corner. That's what they were doing here, hoping he'd flip out again, so this time they could wash their hands of him. But it wasn't going to be so easy for them this time, because this time someone loved him and needed him. This time he'd have to fight back. The Monsignor closed the door behind him and leaned on the desk facing the unshaven priest, whose hair was greasy and uncombed. His soiled clerical collar was limp and creased, and there was a disagreeable odor about him. Father Gannon was clearly out of control. For the past 2 nights, the Monsignor had been sickened by the feeble sobbing from the curate's room. Mrs. Arkaday had confirmed his lack of bathing, and this morning she said he wasn't eating anything to speak of but coffee and sweets. When the phone rang, he'd snatch it up on the first ring, then forget to pass on the messages to the Monsignor. And now he had violated the Monsignor's direct order. It enraged him to see Father Gannon's foolish grin as he twirled a pen between his fingers.
How can you sit there? Don't you have anything to say? You've disgraced your vocation and humiliated me. You have caused a scandal. And worse, you chose as your partner in sin the niece of one of my dearest parishioners.
At this, Father Gannon's head bobbed with some brief amusement. The Monsignor gripped the back of the chair. What disturbed him most was this pharisaical air, as if he thought his priestliness of a higher, purer order than the Monsignor's, some divine aegis for which he was being so unjustly punished, so constantly tormented. The Monsignor's stomach rumbled and his cheeks ballooned with a swallowed belch. In addition to gallstones, he had an ulcer. The doctor had put him on such a restrictive diet that he couldn't sleep through the night, so violent were his hunger pangs. These last few evenings he found himself hurrying up to bed earlier and earlier, his cassock pocket sagging with the dinner biscuits and cold chicken Mrs. Arkaday left, so providentially transportable in wax paper bags. It occurred to him that these stomach problems had begun last spring, about the time of Father Gannon's arrival. So it wasn't intemperate eating habits after all, but the tension and anxiety this disturbed curate had brought into his life. From the start, all Father Gannon had to do was walk into the room, and the Monsignor would feel his temperature rising, his throat swelling in his collar. The man was always touching, grasping, picking up things that were not his, reading the Monsignor's mail just because it was there, nervously sliding open drawers and cupboard doors while he spoke in that rush of words boiling over with some new cause or indignation. His most recent concern had been Howard, who would surely die of a broken heart if his sister married Grandine Carson. Father Gannon had proposed moving the dim-witted caretaker into the rectory guest room. It was for guests, visiting clergy, the Monsignor had countered. A room over the garage, then. They could build it themselves, he and Howard, Father Gannon had declared, slashing his pen back and forth across the bottom of the sermon he had been working on. See, a bedroom, parlor, small bath. He had drawn a floor plan. No need for a kitchen. Howard could take his meals with them. No, no, no. He almost had to shout before Father Gannon understood. The Monsignor had done his best, and this time no one could accuse him of not trying. He had been through this years ago with one of his first curates, but that had been more delicate. Not only had the curate fondled the nephew of the Holy Name Society president, but the curate himself had been the nephew of Father Mulcahy, treasurer of the diocese. At least this should be fairly easy. Father Gannon was a nobody with a history of spiritual and mental instability, and Alice Vermoyle, well, knowing her kind, She was probably the cause of this whole mess.
I'm going to ask the bishop to transfer you, Father, and in the meantime, you're not to have anything to do with anyone.
Father Gannon looked up and smiled.
Especially with that Fermoil girl, he added.
All he needed now was Marie Fermoil, that disagreeable woman, charging in here again. The bishop returned his call an hour later.
Are you sure?
Came the bishop's equable response to every allegation.
Am I sure? Am I sure?
The Monsignor finally exploded.
Don't you understand? There was a girl in his bed, and I was there, the three of us, naked, so of course I'm sure.
Slow down now, Tom. You're confusing me. I'm just trying to get the picture here, that's all,
said the bishop.
Well, it's not a very pretty picture, let me tell you,
the Monsignor said, his mouth against the sweaty receiver. There was a pause.
The thing I don't understand, Tom, is why you were undressed.
No, he groaned. Not me.
When he had finally explained everything, the bishop said,
This is a shame. A terrible shame. I had some real hope for that young man. There was something about him, you know what I mean, Tom, that old-fashioned zeal you just don't get anymore. Ah, that's too bad to hear. It's been so misdirected. I'm disappointed. I really, really am.
Misdirected? The Monsignor's jowls smarted as if he'd just been slapped. The bishop not only didn't understand, but he thought it was the Monsignor's fault. Suddenly he found himself telling the bishop how sick he'd been, how bloated and constipated he was, how he couldn't concentrate. It was all the pressure. The convent was leaking again, and Sister William Teresa was demanding a new roof. Demanding! And when he told her there were no funds for a new roof, she had the gall to ask him where the funds for the next spring's trip to Rome were coming from. That was his silver anniversary trip, which, by the way, he wanted the bishop to be sure and know, just in case Sister should try and raise a stink over this, his cousin Nora was paying for. He still couldn't believe the way that nun had dared speak to him. The same with Father Gannon, who'd gone from calling him Tom to sleeping with women in his rectory. The old order was crumbling. He hoped the bishop knew how short a path it was from impudence to anarchy.
Chaos, Your Excellency. That's what it's come to. You asked me to be patient, but this man needs help.
What kind of help do you mean?
There was a rustle of pages turning, as if the bishop had been reading a newspaper.
He needs to be locked up. That's what he needs.
Tom, he's already spent a year in the hospital, and he came out with a clean bill of health. Maybe he just got a little overburdened.
A little overburdened?
His flesh burned with insult.
You said you left him completely in charge. It was probably too much for him.
Too much for him?
Look, Tom, I'll call his provincial and get someone down there to talk to him. In the meantime, maybe you could lighten the young fellow's load a little.
The Monsignor was stunned.
And by the way, Tom, we're a little short of our goal statewide for the Bishop's Relief Fund. Maybe you could pick up part of the slack with a special collection this Sunday.
But it's St. Mary's first fuel collection this Sunday, he said in a cold voice.
Try to fit it in sometime soon, then,
the bishop said airily, adding that he wished they could talk longer, but he was having a few people in for dinner, and he really had to hurry. The Monsignor slumped in the dark room's early twilight. What did the bishop care with his handsome face and silver-streaked hair that belonged up on a movie screen and not beneath the jeweled satin mitre that would never be the Monsignor's? Overhead, the floorboards creaked as Father Gannon paced back and forth in his room. For 2 days now, the house had smelled of vinegary spices and steamed vegetables from his sister's canning. Samuel Fermoil felt good, stronger, healthier than he could ever remember. It was mid-afternoon, and he was on his way to see his daughter. When he had called earlier to see if Alice would be home, Benji would only say, "Probably." The conversation had been so strained that he'd almost decided not to go. But it was time to see them. He was ready. He braced his foot on the window sill and tied his shoe. It was this easy, he thought, doubling the knot, leaving nothing to chance, not a moment untended. That had been the true lesson of Applegate. Not any of their psychological shit, but the order that had prevailed there. As he headed out the door, he heard Helen's voice rise sharply in the kitchen, and then Josiah's angry reply. They had been bickering for the past hour. Josiah wanted something, whether a raise or time off he couldn't tell from her muttered demands, but Helen was growing angrier in her refusals. He felt himself borne by a great calm, an enlightenment, a contagion of wisdom and joy he would spread among his family, those doubters like his sister who expected nothing more of him than the inevitable misstep, the lie, the omission. He passed the rectory and smiled at Howard, who was dragging a garden hose down the church walkway. "Hello there," he called, but Howard continued to tug at the hose and did not look up. It was then that he noticed the young curate sitting on the bottom rung of a ladder that leaned against the back of the church. "Hello, Father. Lovely afternoon, isn't it?" he called. "Okay," he muttered as Father Gannon looked quickly down into the bucket at his feet. "Just keep going, keep going," he told himself, determined to squelch the dread stirring in his brain. The Monsignor had probably warned the young priest not to get too friendly. A sudden image of himself shouting drunkenly at Father Gannon and careening through the polished rectory vestibule shot into his head. Jesus! Once again he found himself adrift between the future's terrifying void and the past, an even stranger emptiness, festering with so many of these amnesiac violations and humiliations. It was like being stalked by his own maniacal twin. He began to feel shaky. Maybe he wasn't ready to see the kids. Maybe they didn't want to see him. That's why Benji had sounded so funny. After all, not one of them had bothered to see how he was doing, not even a phone call. Didn't they care? Didn't they know how hard he was trying? At the corner, he turned toward the park. He was surprised to hear rock and roll music blasting. The bandstand was filled with musicians. Because they weren't in uniform, he thought they were only practicing. But then he realized no one was playing an instrument. They stared glumly up at the podium, where Jardine Green was waving his arms and shouting over the raucous din that they were a sorry group of musicians who had lost their passion.
"Play it big," he cried, raising his baton. "Play it so big and so full of yourself that you'll forget the fool is there. Drown him out. Obliterate him."
As they took up their instruments, a few of the musicians glanced toward Joey Selden, who sat on a stool in his lopsided stand where speakers amplified his radio songs. Two trash barrels were overflowing onto the ground. Bottles and popcorn boxes were everywhere in the grass and on the sidewalk. Three sides of the stand were buttressed by stacked cases of empty bottles and cans.
"Gusto, gusto, gusto!"
Green shouted as the band played When the Caissons Go Rolling Along.
"Joey!"
Sam hollered, banging his fist on the counter, trying to be noticed through the concussion of music.
"What do you want?"
Joey yelled.
"It's me, Joey, Sam from Oil," he hollered, leaning closer.
The aluminum doors under the popcorn machine were ajar, and Sam was shocked to see a large black gun inside.
"Plain or buttered?"
Joey got off the stool.
"Not today,"
he shouted, then tried to explain that he'd just stopped by to say hello and see how things were going.
"That's how they're going," Joey said, pointing to the curled cardboard sign tacked overhead.
It was an eviction order signed by Judge R. L. Begley. Now that he had been ordered to shut down, the town claimed it was no longer responsible for picking up trash from an illegal business. As a result, he had also been served with public health violations.
"It's all him,"
Joey shouted, pointing at Jardine Green, whose body appeared to be vibrating on the podium. Across the street, the pharmacy door flew open, and Marco, the druggist, stood on the top step in his starched white smock, shouting into a bullhorn.
"Joey, turn off the radio. I repeat, Joey, turn off the radio. If you do not turn off the radio, then I am calling the police. I repeat, I am calling the police, and this time I'm swearing out a complaint."
Turning, Joey reached under the counter, and for a chilling moment, Sam was certain he'd pull out the pistol and start firing away. Instead, the radio went louder. Joey had turned it up.
"Joey! Joey!" he shouted. "What are you doing?"
"Same as they're doing to me. Harassment!"
Joey shouted.
"I'll stop when they stop."
Sam hurried down Main Street. When he got to Marie's, Benji told him through the half-open door that Alice was sick in bed. Relieved, he took a step down. No, he was here. He'd only stay a minute. Maybe he could make her feel better.
"I don't think so," Benji said, letting him in.
"She's really not feeling good," he whispered, glancing toward the stairs.
"What does she have, a cold?"
Benji's eyes flicked away, then back again.
"I don't know. But she's really sick."
Alice lay on her side, curled under the blanket. With the window shade down, he couldn't see her face on the pillow, just tangled hair.
"Alice,"
he whispered, touching the back of her head.
"It's me, pet. It's Daddy."
Her breathing seemed to stop. He said he would have called sooner, but did she know he was still a fugitive from the loony bin? It was too bad there wasn't a reward out for him, because then at least she could make a few bucks off her old man. He laughed. She hadn't moved. He had a new job, did she know that? Well, it was a real cushy position, he chuckled. Toilet paper. He had always wanted a career in toilet paper. Bet she didn't know that about her old man. It promised to be a real clean-up job. That is, if he didn't mind wiping someone else's... Oops, sorry for that rude slip. Well, anyway, it was a real sit-down job if she knew what that meant.
"Hun, are you awake?"
He cleared his throat. Okay, let's see. What other news was there? Rainey and Helen were fine. Nana wasn't doing too well. Yesterday, the doctor had given her two more shots. Helen said they were penicillin and B12, but he was convinced it was some new embalming fluid. Nana just laid there. Well, sat up, really, to keep the fluid from accumulating in her lungs. She never sang anymore. Every once in a while, her eyes would open wide, but usually they were closed. Let's see.
What else?
He told her he was reading a biography of F. Scott Fitzgerald. He was thinking of maybe getting all his teeth out and investing in some new choppers.
Jesus,
he thought.
She doesn't want to hear about that.
He cleared his throat and asked how Marie was doing. She didn't answer. He asked if she'd do him a favor. Would she please tell her mother to stop throwing those pebbles up against his window every night? Thinking the bed jiggled with her faint laughter, he touched her shoulder and leaned closer.
Hey, what's this I hear about you and the new priest?
He felt her hunch up.
Something about going into the convent? Is it true, Alice?
She curled into a ball and moaned. He took his hand away and said he hoped he hadn't upset her. Well, whatever she wanted to do with her life was fine with her old man. There was a gasp. The bed shook.
I mean that, pet. I know I haven't always been much of a... well, the kind of a... kind of father you deserve. But I'm trying now, pet. I really am. I feel so good now. And it's more than the job and staying sober. The thing is, I want to make you kids proud of me.
He took a deep breath.
Because I'm really proud of you three kids. Really, really proud, pet.
He realized she was crying into her pillow. He lifted back a strand of her hair.
You know, when you came to see me at Applegate and I made you wait, I wasn't getting ready all that time. Christ, I was so happy you were coming. I'd been up since 5 a.m. getting ready. All that time you were down there, I was just sitting on the edge of my bed. That's what I was doing. Just sitting on the bed and trying to work up enough courage to go down and face you cold sober. I almost didn't make it, he said, sniffing and wiping his runny nose on the back of his hand. But then a nurse came and walked me out to the elevator and pushed the button.
He closed his eyes as she sobbed.
I'm not trying to make you feel bad, pet. I'm just trying to explain something here. You see, when I'm sober, I'm usually walking around, you know, with my tail between my legs, and I'm feeling like such a loser all the time, like I screwed up everything, you know, my whole life, you kids, your mom's life.
But then this day I was in Reenie's shop, and I saw those pictures he had of you kids on the register, and I just got so damn mad. I kept thinking, who the hell is he to put up pictures of my kids? What the hell's he trying to prove? And all that day it just kept bugging the hell out of me. And then that night, in the middle of the night, my eyes opened wide and it hit me. You're not even his kids, and he's so proud of you he wants everyone to know he's your uncle. And here I am. I'm your father. And the thing is, I'm such a shithead. I don't know how to be proud of anything anymore, even my own kids. And I realize you kids are a lot to be proud of. He grinned. I mean that, baby. I really do.
No,
she groaned.
No, 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 no.
He leaned over and tried to hold her, but she recoiled, her body rigid and convulsed with moans.
Oh, God, look what I've done. I didn't mean to upset you like this.
He stood up and reached for the door.
I'll go.
No, 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 no.
Her moans tore through him.
I'll call your mother. She'll...
He covered his ears.
Oh, God, Alice, stop it. I don't know what to do.
No, 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 no.
Benji met him on the stairs. He had to get out of here, away from the boy's torn sneakers, the fuzzy television picture, the caved-in couch, the lamp with its red and gold gypsy, her chipped, dirty arms ending in plaster stumps.
What's wrong with her?
He asked. Benji shrugged and couldn't look at him.
Did something happen? Is it school? Is she nervous about school?
I don't know, Benji muttered.
It's not because of money, is it?
The expression on his son's face said it all.
Oh, shit. Don't tell me that's what happened.
He felt like such a fool with all his talk about getting on his feet and pride in his kids, while she lay up there devastated because she had no money for college. Reenie was dreaming. He and a man had been following the steady heartbeat. They were walking down a narrow corridor. The man opened a door, and the heartbeat stopped. Here there was a sun-drenched laboratory. The white walls were lined with shelves. Glass jars glistened on the shelves. Suspended in the clear liquid that filled every jar was a gelatinous sack. The man said because he had not come, the fetus had been aborted, expelled from Beatrice's coarse womb. Let me see him, Reenie said.
Christ, that was a million years ago, the man said.
Let me see him.
Him? Who? What, you think they give them names?
I want to see him.
You think it's some kind of weird nursery man with the bottles all lined up so the proud pops can come in and look?
The man laughed. Could she have done such a thing? No, it could not be. He struggled to wake up. His eyes closed heavily. He was floating in a jar of pickled cauliflower, and yet he lay here on his bed, perfectly still, his arms folded over his chest, the dim room taking shape around him as he floated in the glassy brine. The lowering sun cast a blush from the window, an acrid stillness whose bilious sediment would stir at the slightest movement and rise to fill his nose and mouth, already puckered with a pinched sting of vinegar that seeped in from the kitchen. Over the bubbly clatter of boiling canning jars came the hollow chop, 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 chop of Helen's knife on the cutting block. It was canning time. She'd started early this year. He couldn't move. He hadn't been to the store in days. Losing Tom had drained him of all hope and energy. All he wanted to do was sleep, and yet it was never enough. He was exhausted, sometimes too weak to lift his head from the pillow. He hadn't eaten, but he wasn't hungry. He knew he had to get up and eat and wash and get back to work, but he was just too tired. For the first time, Sam detected a faint odor of urine from his mother's crib as he passed on his way to the kitchen. Between the canning and his mother's worsening condition, Helen had been on her feet for days. He dreaded going in there, where every surface was littered with peelings, pots, and spice cans. He hoped Helen's mood wasn't as foul as it had been yesterday, when Josiah had walked out in the middle of bathing their mother, Helen muttered something now as a cupboard door banged shut. Water began to run into a pan. He reached between the bars and touched his mother's arm, shivering to find her skin so slackly thin and cold. Her eyes were closed and her mouth gaped open with wheezy breathing. At times she frowned and seemed to wince as if in pain.
"Here we go, Mum," he said with a sigh, then removed the thin notebook from his breast pocket.
This at least would have pleased her. He was going to demand that Helen give him his money for Alice's college expenses. The kitchen was a mess. Helen stood by the stove, her hands bound in white towels. She almost looked like a child in Josiah's long red apron that came to her ankles. Sam sat at the table, which was covered with cucumber peels, tomato skins, corn cobs, seedy pepper cores, and scummy bowls. Helen lifted a rack of mason jars filled with red tomatoes, then lowered it into the kettle on the stove. She set the lid on carefully, pausing a moment before she turned. She glanced from Renee's closed door to the yellow notebook in Sam's hand.
"Lunch is long gone," she said, unwinding the towels from her hand.
"I ate," he said.
"If it's supper you're after, get it yourself."
She began slicing cucumber rounds with a long, sharp knife.
"Is that the knife Dad used in the store?"
he asked.
"How would I know?"
He had forgotten. It had been Helen who had walked in on their father and the Sicilian tenant's daughter in the back room of the little grocery. After that, neither Helen nor their mother ever again entered the store.
"You look tired," he said.
"Look tired?"
she said, with such an angry fling of the sweating white rounds into the bowl that the vinegar splattered in her face. She took off her glasses and wiped her eyes.
"Why do you bother with all this, Helen?"
"What should I do? Let it rot?"
Her voice quivered as if under the weight of a question she had asked herself countless times.
"Send some over to Marie and the kids,"
he suggested with a twinge of pity now for his sister, whose garden grew because it had to, who had no friends to share her harvest.
"Ha!"
she snorted.
"That's good, coming from you."
She spooned sugar into the fizzing marinade, then carried the bowl to the sink. On the stove, the pressure was rising in the dull steel cooker, hissing and vibrating loudly. Helen reached for the rattling lid, and a jet of steam whooshed against her wrist. She jerked back her hand with an angry cry. He wet a towel and tried to hold it to the red splotch on her wrist. She knocked away his hand and the towel fell on the floor.
"Leave me alone,"
she cried as she bent to pick it up.
"Helen!"
"Get out," she said. "Just get out and leave me alone. Everyone, just leave me alone."
"Helen, there are other people you can get to help."
"Ha! Misfits! Nothing but misfits! The misfits I've wasted my life on. All these years I kept her on rather than see her used by such filth, such—"
She was crying, the tears and the kettle's harumphing steam fogging her glasses when she looked back at him.
"My father, my brother, my mother," she moaned. "And did I ever ask for anything? Did I?"
she demanded.
"For myself? No. All I've ever wanted was a little respect, that's all. Some pride. That's all I've ever wanted," she cried, striking the table top with the knife handle. "Just to be able to hold my head high, that's all. That's all I've ever, ever, ever wanted."
"Helen, don't. Don't cry."
He felt terrible.
"Don't cry? After what Josiah told me, that's all I can do."
She looked at him and shook her head.
"She used it on me. Took that filth and used it on me. No, I told her, that's impossible. It couldn't be. Not Alice."
"What? What are you talking about?"
"Well, don't worry. I called the Monsignor. I called him myself because I knew no one else in this family would have the decency to do it."
She dabbed her eyes with her apron hem.
"And he said I wasn't to take on any more burdens. He said it was their sin, their filth."
He sprang at her.
"What the hell are you talking about?"
She drew back, almost daintily, her demeanor sweetened, calmed by his fury.
"Alice and the new curate, the two of them, naked in the rectory. That poor sick man, the Monsignor.
I'll tell you just what I told him. Sin breeds sin, Samuel Fermoil. Dirt breeds dirt.
Her head snapped back as his hand rose.
Go ahead, she cried. The last defilement, she hissed, glaring at his fist. Don't say another word about my daughter, do you hear me?
He growled, then stepped away.
Oh, I won't. Believe me, I won't, she said in a trembling voice.
Now he understood why Alice couldn't look at him. His temples throbbed, and yet he was able to remove himself to do this.
I want my money, Helen. I need it.
He opened his notebook and was steadied by the cool recitation of his figures. He had computed the sum after expenses, room and board, to be $6,000. He glanced at her.
$6,000 in trust.
Gone,
she interrupted. He looked up, confused by her smile. She must be kidding.
On your haircuts and your shoes and food and laundry bills. On all the money you ever stole from me, the things you broke, the people you owed, Reenie's car you smashed up.
$6,000, Helen.
She was in the closet now, feeling along the shelf over Reenie's clothes. She pulled down a worn tablet and began to read.
December 20, 1956. $2, Mrs. Camus. Christmas wreath stolen by Sam. December 29, 1956, 1185, Atkinson Free Library, 5 lost books. January 9, 1957, $102, renew upholsterers, reupholster plum brocade sofa after Sam's cigarette burns. January 12, 1957, $55, ambulance to Waterbury. May 31st, 1957, $13, Mrs. Camus' American flag slept in by Sam on her back porch, then vomited on. June 8th, 1957, $18, Dr. Horace R. Reynolds, house call and medicine, Sam's tremors. June 9th, 1957, $25 fine, district court for being a public nuisance. Same date, $45 legal fees to Abner Atkinson. September 1, 1957.
Public nuisance.
He chuckled.
September 1, 1957, she repeated.
Shut up, Helen.
Let me finish, she said, flipping the pages. The last entry is your total bill paid to the Applegate Corporation, and that was, she said, glancing up, as of August 1st, $3,469.
She closed the tablet.
Bringing you to $10,500.34.
Right over the top.
He sighed, his head pounding.
Gotta hand it to you, Helen. I am not only a fucking public nuisance, but a fucking public idiot. You know, that's the one thing I couldn't figure out. Why Applegate, I kept wondering, and Dr. Litchfield, Thed, your thithter only wants the best for you, Themmy.
He hung his head over his own meager figures.
Don't do this to me, Helen. You've done it, not me, she said,
stepping past him to return the tablet to its shelf in the closet. She began to snap string beans in two.
Marie needs my help.
She looked at him over her glasses.
What does she need your help for now that she's finally got herself a boyfriend? Your wife and your daughter, they certainly make a good pair.
Shut up, Helen.
He leaned over the table. She was deliberately goading him. He had to be careful. To call the police and have him hauled out of here would give her great satisfaction right now.
There's one more thing, something you and the good judge neglected to tell me. This is my house. Mine.
This is Mother's house, she said, outraged.
Yes, and when she dies, it's mine. And the tenements go to...
He read from his notes what Marie had told him.
They go to Samuel's heirs, as well as any issue of my daughter, Helen.
There was no color in her face. Her huge breasts rose and fell.
You shouldn't have exiled Reenie in there, Helen, he said,
pointing to the door with its arterial fissures of ancient paint.
You should have produced at least one issue, Helen. Messy, I know. but at least it would have been a good investment.
He couldn't help laughing.
Shut your filthy mouth! You make me sick!
She tried to leave, but he blocked her way.
Tell me, Helen, where will you and Reenie be living when I throw you the fuck out of here? I know. Maybe the kids will rent you an apartment in one of the tenements, Helen. Wouldn't that be great? You and Reenie with all those low-class tenants. They love you so much, Helen.
You're evil, she said, staring up at him.
No, not evil, Helen. I've never been evil, just stupid and weak.
Your self-pity disgusts me. You've lived off pity all your life.
You mean mother, don't you?
Poor mother. Do you have any idea how ashamed she'd be if she knew about Alice and that priest?
Her voice broke.
First it was you, and now it's your children disgracing this family.
He laughed.
Oh, what family? You and me and mother? I know you don't mean you and Reenie, because he's just another tenant, isn't he? I'll bet he doesn't know he's out on his ass the minute mother's gone. No, you didn't tell him either, did you? Why? Were you afraid he'd want to move somewhere just the two of you? Disgusting thought, isn't it? No, better to keep mother here. Keep her alive so you could devote yourself to her, Helen. Being a saintly daughter's been a hell of a lot easier than being a wife, hasn't it?
Get out of my way!
She tried to get to the back door, but he blocked it. He was almost enjoying this.
All the poor bastard ever wanted was for someone to be nice to him. You know how pathetic he is? He has a cat in the store, and he has to hide it. He has to keep it a secret from you, from his own wife, the poor bastard. You couldn't even let him have his dog, you—
Stop! Stop it!
She cried, looking at Reenie's door, but he knew Reenie was at the store.
Please, stop it!
You made Howard poison it. I mean, Jesus, Helen. Do you know what his life is like? People laugh at him. My kids can't stand him. He's a joke. He's a fool. Do you know who turned him into the IRS? Marie. And do you know why? Because he's so goddamn pathetic he tried to force himself on her. On my wife. On his own sister-in-law. So don't hold your nose for too long, sister. You'll suffocate. The stink is here. It's right here. With you.
Reenie waited in his room on his narrow bed. He waited until Sam had gone to work. He waited until he heard the familiar squeal of Bridget's crib as Helen let down the slatted side to change the old woman's diaper. And then he slipped out of his room and out the kitchen door. He passed lightly down the back stairs. He passed the rectory and the church, head down, eyes averted, not with shame, but with this pangless, numbing grief. Nothing was safe. There was no way to possess love. It would always flee from him. The store was hot and airless. A thin veneer of dust claimed every surface. On the back steps, the milk had curdled in the dish and the blood-stained tuna was swarming with flies. He went into the bathroom. He tore the pictures from the walls, and then he sat on the closed toilet lid with the telephone book in his lap. He stared at the telephone on the soiled linoleum. Marie had reported him to the IRS. Internal Revenue. The irony of her revenge cut like blades through his heart. Pathetic. Sam was right. It hadn't been the brandy that night at the Elks or joy at bringing them a turkey, but desire, this blind turbulence, this yearning. He was ashamed. Everything he had ever done for Marie and the children had been a tainted, venal transaction. It was true. No one wanted to waste their time on a fool like Reenie LeChance. Even the cat had escaped through the first unguarded door. His business grew worse every year. What respect was there to be had when his own wife could barely tolerate his presence? He had lost the golden toasty line because he had wanted it too much. Better not to care, not to want, not to love, not to feel anything at all. He came out of the bathroom and went directly to the gas display model, the one stove hooked up to the main. He opened the oven door, then turned on all the knobs to high. The steady hiss was almost amusing, like air seeping from a huge balloon.
With the high ceilings and drafty windows and doors, it would take a long time for the lethal fumes to work. Might as well keep busy, he thought, taking the roll of masking tape from under the counter. He began to seal the gaps around the doors and windows. He worked most methodically, butting each strip end to the next, pressing the tape smooth. There would be no doubt as to his intentions. He smiled, imagining everyone shocked to realize what a man of action he could be. This was the ultimate courage. All the women he called would regret their inability to save him. Now, that was impossible, because none of them knew their loving caller's identity. If only he'd told someone his name, he thought, as he began to seal the gap around the front door. He should have spoken up, should have demanded Helen's love. He glanced up. Across the street, a pretty woman tugged her little girl along by the hand as they hurried through Cushing's parking lot. The little girl tripped and fell face down. Her screams jolted through him. The tape crackled and peeled away as he forced open the door. The woman had picked up the screaming child and was carrying her into the store. He could not help himself. He hurried across the street. When he got inside the store, the woman was nowhere in sight. Confused, he watched the red lights over the elevator blink down from floor to floor. The doors swooped open, and now he was inside. "Fourth floor, Mr. LeChance? Mr. Cushing's office?" Arlo asked, cranking the latticed metal doors closed. His heart was racing. He felt dizzy. He had gotten here too quickly. It was all so dreamlike. Maybe it was the gas. Yes, that was it. The gas. And this was the end, the last passage, up, up, up. The elevator glided to a smooth stop and the doors opened. Maybe it was a baby girl, he thought, a daughter, a sweet and lovely young woman, newly married and just setting up housekeeping. Odd that he'd never considered a daughter before. His heart soared as he came down the corridor. It was a long walk. The door seemed so far away. Oh, yes. This was so much easier. A daughter would be so much more understanding. He opened the door, and Mr. Cushing's wizened head bobbed up. He had been dozing. There were indentations on his cheek from the buttons on his sleeves.
"Renee,"
he smiled and held out a trembling hand.
"I was just thinking about you."
Reverend Peace was out of the hospital now, and Luther was tired of working, but at least he'd been well fed. He'd spent the 10 days in Asheville washing dishes in the Kidey-Ho family-style chicken restaurant for gas money and a place to stay, while the old man got his plumbing cleared. Food was plentiful, right off the plates through the dishwasher's steamy cubbyhole. Amazing how much came back. Whole thighs and biscuits swamped in chicken gravy. Congealed, but tasty all the same, he liked to tell the old man. Desserts were the best, though. Every kind of pudding. Bread, grape nut, rice and raisin, lemon sponge, butterscotch, and his favorite, deep dark chocolate. Every morning, Luther went to the hospital expecting to collect the Reverend and be on their way north to find Early. And every morning, the bald, bug-eyed doctor said the old man still wasn't 100%. Luther could tell the doctor was scared stiff of him, but he didn't show even a flash of temper until the 10th morning. Clutching Luther's arm with his cold, bony fingers, the old man begged to be taken out of there so they could be on their way. It truly was time to go. Luther would miss the Kidey-Ho's tender chicken, but just his luck, the tiny waitress who'd made room in her bed for him had turned out to be one of them crazy-when-drunk ladies that wanted to fight every breathing soul, including him. Night before last, when the police came banging on the trailer door, he was sure they were going to finally haul him back to prison in Baton Rouge to the weed-clearing road crew he'd slipped away from one day, like a shadow into the night, is what it had felt like. But they took one look at the ice-packed shiner she'd given him, who was 3 times her size anyway, and they laughed, asking did he want to be taken into protective custody, or did he just want to be on his way? Be on his way, of course. Out of town and long gone before anyone thought to check old wanted posters. The doctor had tried being angry, but not too angry, which Luther took as admission he'd done as much for the old man as he could. They drove only 120 miles the first day. The The old man had to drink a glass of water and take 2 pills every hour, which was causing him to pee every 20 minutes. He was supposed to rest, which he could do well enough in the car, but he wasn't supposed to get overheated, which was nearly impossible in 95-degree heat. He could barely eat. He said his stomach was too flooded. By night, the old man was so weak and trembling that Luther was certain he was dying. He rented a cabin and sat up, wringing out wet towels to pack on the old man's feverish head and chest. The old man kept begging for the cold, sweet cherries he insisted Luther was hiding.
"You are a liar,"
the old man cried, the few inches he raised his head off the pillow a remarkable feat after all his weakness.
"Liar,"
he cried, as Luther hurried back with another dripping towel. As Luther bent over him, he seized the wet towel and flung it, its heavy wetness slapping Luther's face. Eyes wide, he struggled to sit up.
"Liar,"
he cried again. Holding him down, Luther told him to shut up and lay still or he'd leave. He'd walk out that door, and he would, knew he would, and knew he wouldn't think twice about it after. No kin of his, the old man was nothing but a terrible burden now, even a danger. The old man's mouth trembled. The whites of his eyes were so yellow and blood-streaked they reminded Luther of the baby clots he was always sickened to find in eggs. It was a sign. Of what, Luther wasn't sure, but he could feel his blood run cold and the hair on his arms stand up. They were never going to find Early. Early was dead. The old man wasn't looking for Early. He was looking for someone to die with him, and it wasn't going to be Luther Corbett. He backed toward the door with the old man still staring at him. The chambermaid would come in a few hours and call an ambulance. He'd be better off dying in the hospital. Luther slipped into the dark and closed the door. Yes, sir, he assured himself as he drove off. This was the right thing to do. Crazy old man like that needed a bed to lie in and kinder hands than his. Whew, he sighed, relieved that it wasn't his problem now. The sharp sliver of moon hung like a scythe blade in the black sky. When he was back on the highway, he got the old station wagon up to 70, fast as it would go without shimmying. Duval said he had bought this car brand new, but then, when Early found a child's shoe wedged in the back seat, Duval forgot and said it must belong to the man he'd bought it from in Tupelo. That child's shoe had been a sign. He'd forgotten how nervous it had made Duval. Early had been too trusting. Even that last day, he still thought he could reason with a snake like Duval. All Early wanted then was to get back to Lady Dwelly.
"We got the car," the old man kept saying. "We got the car, and we're still all together. Tell him,"
the old man had begged Luther. But Early kept insisting they get their money as well. Early and the old man were too easy. They hadn't lived among the evil. They didn't know, couldn't hear it and see it the way he did. He should have been the one to go after Duval that day. But they knew if he did, he'd kill him. He kept thinking of the old man, how scared he'd be come morning. And where was he even going? He had no place to go. Alone, he was on the run, a fugitive again. He pulled onto the soft shoulder and turned back the way he'd just come. The old man tried to lift his head as he came through the door.
"Here,"
Luther said, sitting down and paring away the soft, fuzzy skin off one of the peaches he'd just picked.
"You just close your eyes now and dream on cherries."
He carved a juicy chunk from the warm peach and put it in the old man's mouth. In the next 2 days, they were able to get as far north as D.C. The old man slept most of the time. When he did wake up, it was only for brief snatches of confusion and wide-eyed dreams in which he thought Luther was his father, daughter, wife, and Early. Sometimes it was like having the whole Peace family right there in the car. At first he tried to set the old man straight, but he soon tired of shouting,
"I'm Luther! It's Luther you're talking to!"
over the engine noise and the highway roar of the open windows and the old man's anxious chatter. So he gave in and got to know the family. Lornilda Peace had been a saint of a wife. All she lived for was to make her reverend husband happy, except in one regard, thus forcing him into
the wilderness for relief.
which is all it was, he kept insisting. Just physical relief. Luther smiled and nodded as the old man scolded his daughter for planting bush beans when it was only pole beans he'd ever had. He looked at Luther now and asked if they were almost there.
Almost, Luther assured him. Good, the old man said. I haven't been to the grave, and I promise I would.
Luther shivered with a chill. Grave? What grave? Then the old man was asleep again, his head tilted back against the door, his slender fingers twined in his lap, the untrimmed yellow nails curled and bent. If they did find that Early was dead, he wouldn't let anyone tell the old man he'd lost his only living kin.
Early? Help me, Early boy. I'm in, oh, so much pain.
The words bubbled from deep in the old man's chest. He wrenched the wheel and changed lanes, pulling out so quickly that horns blared all around him. The old man stared at him as the car skidded into the breakdown lane.
No,
Luther insisted, squeezing the unyielding bony arm.
Come on, come on, come on, we almost there.
The eyes didn't blink or close. It didn't take but a few minutes to cover him with a blanket and arrange him, stretched out in the back of the station wagon. He continued north. Not sure of anything now but this looming emptiness. Nothing to do and nowhere to go. With a magazine crew, he'd been part of something, and even after that he'd had the old man. A cruiser passed now and his foot lifted from the gas pedal. At the next rest area, he pulled in and parked at the end of the strip. There were two other cars in here. As soon as they left, he would get out, run through the woods, emerge farther down the highway and start thumbing. The police would see that the old man got buried. Maybe a few people would say the kind of prayers and sing the kind of hymns a man of God deserved. The first car had left, but the woman in the second car was putting on lipstick and spraying her hair. She leaned close to the mirror and squeezed something on her chin. The police wouldn't know the old man was a preacher. No one would know, and no one would care. He started the engine and drove onto the highway until he came to an exit. He took the first route south he came to. He drove all that day, most of the night, then the next day into the night. He wasn't hardly tired. In fact, he could feel himself growing more alert. He was bringing the old man to his only living relative, his great-grandson, the child of Early and Lady Dwelly. He was doing a good thing. And he hoped the old man knew it. Norm raised the hood and fiddled with the carburetor. It had finally happened. He had run out of tricks. The engine was dead. He was already late for work, and soon his mother would be too. She was behind the wheel, frantically pumping the accelerator. She told him to go inside and get Duval.
My mother said to wake you up.
He poked Duval's arm, amazed at his energy just seconds after sleep. He jumped out of bed and followed him outside, zipping his pants and buttoning his shirt. He would give them a ride to work.
It's the alternator. That's where the trouble is,
Norm grumbled, climbing into the back seat of Duval's car. He sat behind his mother.
The trouble is, it's junk, she said, the lilt in her voice surprising him.
Duval smiled at her as he turned the key and his own car started right up.
It's all in the maintenance, he said, lecturing Norm through the rearview mirror. Oil, plugs, filters, simple as that. Just a little extra time and attention now saves a whole lot of money later.
Words to live by,
Norm muttered as he stared out the side window. Duval's lecture continued, with his mother smiling at him. With the soap shipment due next week, she seemed impervious to every setback. The disaster with Alice had only made his mother more determined. She had called the bursar's office at UVM, and they agreed to extend the first semester payment until the end of the month. The bank was sending threatening letters, which she tore up and threw away. When his father called to say Helen had spent the money in his trust and there was nothing he could do about it, all she said was,
"For God's sake, Sam, when the hell are you going to stand up on your own 2 feet?"
Hope was around the corner, bright as a new penny just waiting to be found.
Every night this week, she'd had Norm and Benji combing the phone book for names of people to send letters to and pamphlets describing Presto soap. She'd insisted that Alice come downstairs and help, but every time Alice heard a familiar name, she'd start to cry. At first, Marie tried to ignore it, but then she got mad. She said Alice had to snap out of it and get on with life. It was time to get back to her job and start getting her things ready for college. Alice just sat there shaking her head, crying, until Marie relented and let her go back to hide in her room. His mother had been typing the letters for the soap promotion at work, using Mr. Briscoe's envelopes and stamps.
"Believe me,"
Duval had assured her last night at the table as they licked the stamps and sealed the envelopes,
"it's the way things are done in business."
She pointed now, and Omar stopped at the mailbox in front of Marco's pharmacy. She was afraid if she took the letters to the post office, Mr. Briscoe would somehow find out. She kept looking around now as she passed the bundled letters through the window to Norm. He dropped them into the mailbox a few at a time, as she instructed. When he started back, she told him to check the mailbox to make sure none had gotten stuck. He checked. None had. Was he sure? Yes. Getting back in, he saw Duval roll his eyes at him. Asshole, he thought. They would never be on the same side.
One thing you can't ever do enough of, and that's promotion, Duval mused as they drove along.
But it's starting to add up so, she said.
Yeah, Benji counted 110 letters last night, he called from the back seat.
And 97 the day before, she sighed and shook her head. Every time I look at Mr. Briscoe, I feel so guilty.
Well, don't, Duval said.
It's almost the same as stealing, she said.
Yeah,
Norm called up to her. I read that. It's called white-collar crime.
No, 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 Duval insisted. It's all factored into the cost of doing business. The percentage of expectable loss, it's called. P-O-E-L.
He kept glancing over at her.
In business, you start with that. The POEL is how you say it. It's a given. Mistakes, damage, shoplifting, petty theft.
Norm interrupted, then scratched his head.
Or is that larceny?
His eyes scored Duval's in the mirror.
What's grand larceny? Is that the same as embezzling? What's the difference? I don't know, Norm,
Duval said.
Really? I'm surprised.
His mother's head shot around. And what's that supposed to mean? Why did you say that?
Ignore it, Marie. I intend to.
No, I'm sick of his mouth. I'm sick of the way he talks to you.
Forget it, Marie. I got a very thick skin, case you haven't noticed.
She hit the top of the seat.
You can't stand seeing things get better, can you, Norm? Well, I'm sick of your sniping. I'm just sick of it.
He'd gone too far, and now he was going to pay for the stalled car and all her guilt over Briscoe's stamps and envelopes. They were turning the corner onto Claxton Road toward the municipal garage. His crew was just climbing onto two trucks. They looked up as the car approached, and he was pleased that they'd been waiting for him.
You apologize to Omar, right now!
Duval parked in front of the truck. Kenny Doyle, his foreman, leaned over the wheel and peered down quizzically. Duval turned to Norm with a patronizing smile.
Apologize!
She demanded. The silence in the car crackled. The windows were open. She'd sit out here all day if she had to, and then all night and on until she got her way. Kenny leaned out of the cab.
You coming, kid?
He hollered.
Apologize,
she said, loudly enough to make every man on the truck look down.
I gotta go,
he jumped out and started toward the truck.
Sorry I'm late,
he called up to Kenny, who looked past him. A car door slammed shut, and from the corner of his eye, he saw a tornadic blur.
You get back here right now, his mother called as she stormed toward him. Mom!
He couldn't believe she'd do this, not with all the guys in the truck watching, guys he'd spent the whole summer getting to respect him.
Don't you dare walk away from me, ever!
She squeezed his arm, and for the first time he realized how small this woman was, skinny, almost fragile.
Do you hear me?
She demanded in the shadow of the big truck, with the leathery-skinned, broad-shouldered men looming over them.
Mom, please, he said in a low voice. They're waiting for me. They can wait. Mom, they can hear you. Good. And they're going to hear more if you don't get back there and apologize.
she said even louder. Not a sound came from either truck as he followed her back to the car and mumbled an apology to Duval, who offered his hand. He hesitated.
Norm?
She warned. He shook Duval's hand.
Apology accepted,
Duval said with a somber nod. He started the car, and they drove off. Norm's eyes burned as he walked back to the truck. A buzz of conversation began among the men, as if they hadn't heard or seen a thing. Both trucks started up. He had climbed halfway up the side when his foot skidded off the ridge and he slid back down. His right elbow was scraped. He braced his foot and started to pull himself up, and again his footing was off. This time he banged his knee. It would be a relief if the truck backed up right now and ran over him.
Need a hand, kid?
Bob Hersey pulled him the rest of the way up into the gritty back of the rumbling truck. Hersey had barely spoken to him since his mother's angry call about the car. Shovels, rakes, and picks rattled in their clamps on the back of the cab. Hersey tapped his camels on his fist and offered Norm one. He lit up with a long, painful drag, grateful for the burning in his chest that masked all the other pain, his elbow and knee, his pride.
Your mother and me used to go to the same school,
Hersey said, leaning over the side of the truck as they came through town.
Her father worked for the pig man, like mine did.
He glanced over at Norm.
We come a long way since then,
he paused.
And it ain't always been easy, let me tell you,
he said with a nudge and a wink.
I remember she used to come to school with wet socks. The tops would be so wet and out of shape, you know, they'd hang down on her ankles.
He looked at Norm.
That come from only having the one pair that never did get dry some nights.
In spite of the tattered eviction notice tacked to the post, Joey Selden set up a hot plate to steam frankfurts. He'd beat the hot dog bus at their own game. The next day, Chief Stoner pulled up to the stand. He spoke to Joey from the cruiser.
I got a complaint here, Joey.
The chief looked wan.
What is it now?
Joey sighed, and Sonny told him what he already knew. He had no license to cook. The owner of the hot dog bus had complained, as had residents around the park.
You're not even supposed to be here, so don't push this thing, okay, Joey? I don't have the stomach for it right now.
Sonny sat staring over the wheel. At Mrs. Stoner's funeral, Joey had heard that Eunice had a new boyfriend, a young fellow from Tarrytown who sold toasters.
Look, Chief, don't worry about a thing. I'm on my way downtown, so I'll go to town hall and see what I need.
Joey, you're not listening to me, are you? I don't think you understand how upset people are over this.
Oh, he understood all right, more than Sonny would ever know. After Sonny left, Joey headed out with his cash box in the crook of his arm. He had many errands. Town hall, the bank, the First National for mustard and hot dog rolls. The Atkinson Savings was his first stop. There were only a few customers in the cavernous marble-floored bank, most of them women. As he came through the front door, he saw Cleveland Hines turn quickly and duck back into his office. Had Hines always and so obviously avoided him? He wondered how many others had as well. All these years he had thought himself fortunate to be so well regarded, and all the while people had probably been leaping into bushes and doorways to get away from him. He stood in line behind an old woman with white hair and a pronounced hump on her back. When she turned, he recognized her as a girlhood friend of his younger sister's. Realizing how much he had aged since that night at Towler's had been more of a shock than anything else. His last image in a mirror had been that of a tall, barrel-chested man with black hair and a square, dimpled jaw. Now, an old man had taken his place, white-haired, round-shouldered, and triple-chinned. Ahead on his left, a man in black pants and a black shirt hunched close to the teller's window. He wore a broad-brimmed fedora that concealed his face. The man slid a paper under the grate. As the teller read it, her hand flew to her mouth. He chuckled. She wouldn't be so impressed when she saw his life savings. The old woman counted her money, then put her bank books and cash into her purse. He was still trying to remember her name when she hurried past him. The most frustrating thing about his secret-sightedness was not being able to greet people first. In a sense, he'd been rendered even more invisible, now that he was so keenly aware of being dismissed, avoided, lied to.
"Good morning, Mr. Selden," the teller said with a sweet smile.
"Good morning, dear."
It was a great effort not to gaze at her round, glowing face. He pushed the cash box under the grate. She counted his rolls of coins and the few bills.
$17?
She asked as she rolled his passbook into her typewriter.
$17,
he repeated.
Business is still good,
she murmured as she typed. He grunted. That $17 represented 3 nights' receipts, not 1 night like the old days.
Now,
demanded the man on his left. The man leaned on the counter, his face at the grate. The teller was trying to slide something bulky under the grate. She pushed frantically with both hands, but it wouldn't fit through. The man snapped his fingers and reached over the grate for the brown canvas money bag. Joey's teller glanced up and gasped. The man turned, and Joey stared at his misshapen face with its flat, squashed nose, distorted eyes, and smeared wet lips as he warned the tellers not to move or follow him because he had a gun. The man sprang from the counter. Joey's hand slid into his pocket. Head down, the man lunged past 2 empty desks. Joey called out,
"Stop, or I'll shoot!"
Squinting, he aimed, then pulled the trigger, but there was only a click. The man looked back. It couldn't be empty. He was sure he had 3 bullets in it.
"I said stop!"
Joey roared as the man leaped toward the radiance of the glass doors. The gun exploded. He fired again, and the man fell against the doors.
"Stand back!"
he ordered the tellers, who sobbed in one another's arms, and Cleveland Hines, who peeked from his doorway. He stood over the man, relieved to hear him moaning. With the gun still aimed,